Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Get Booked Podcast, a weekly show for personalized reading recommendations. This is episode 75, and we are recording on April 4th. I'm Jed Northington, and I'm here with Amanda Nelson, and we are coming to you from Book Riot.
Greetings!
Hello! It's Tuesday, and I have Moana songs stuck in my head.
You have what?
Moana songs? Songs from the Moana, the movie.
I thought you said the thong song,
no,
which is
God,
entirely different.
Well, okay, now I'm going to have that stuck in my head, in addition to Disney songs, which is like a whole level of weird.
I was like, all right, Tuesday after dark, I guess. She got dumps like a truck.
I think... Oh my God. Now they're like melding together in my head and it's terrible.
I still haven't seen Moana and I'm ashamed.
You have to go see it, or it's you can borrow it from iTunes now. Like it's on your TV if you have that. It's so
good. Well, that's great. I wanted to take my kids to see it, but I'm unsure of how my children, who are just recently six, will behave in a theater for 2 hours.
So. Well, definitely. It's great. It's Lin-Manuel Miranda did his music and sang in a couple of the songs, actually. And the guy from Flight of the Conchords, Jermaine, what's his face, is one of the bad guys. He does the voice of this giant bad crab. It's amazing. Anyway, okay, enough of my movie reviews. This is the Get Booked Podcast, and it is a reading recommendations show, I promise. So what that means is you send us questions, and we answer them. You can send us all kinds of reading questions. What should your book club read? What should you get for your mom for her birthday? What should you read now that you've finished X title and it has left a hole in your heart? Any of those things and any other reading requests, we are here to help. You can send us your reading recommendation requests either through email, getbooked@bookriot.com. You can drop them into the form that's at the bottom of the show notes on the site for every episode. If you do have a time-sensitive question, please leave the date you need the answer by either in the subject line of the email or the very first line of the form so that we will see it and hopefully get to it in time. If I think we're not going to get to it in time, or your question has been sitting there for a while and I don't want to make you wait any longer, or we've had a similar question, I will email you some recommendations so that you are not waiting forever and ever. And I think that is all of the housekeeping. Yes?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Okay, so we're going to I'm going to read our first question, then Amanda's going to tell us about our first sponsor, and then we're going to launch right into our picks. So the first question comes from Juniper, who says, there is a trope in fan fiction called hurt/comfort. As the name implies, it involves one character getting injured or ill and needing care from another character. There's something about those power dynamics that pushes my buttons, especially if the hurt character is someone who is normally physically and or mentally strong, rather than a quote-unquote princess who always needs saving. If you have suggestions for novels that are action-packed and include hurt, comfort, mortal danger, angst, etc., I would be delighted. They can have a romantic element or not, and straight or LGBT are both welcome. All right.
Okay. So before we get into our answers for that question, we're going to do our first sponsor, which is a romance novel, which is exciting. It's called Only a Mistress Will Do. It's by Jenna Jackson. And this is a historical romance about a woman named Violet who is in kind of dire circumstances. Her family has all passed away. She has no money. And so she's essentially forced to go work at a brothel. Like, she just finds herself on the steps of a brothel. She's just going to put her head down and do the thing and try to survive. So she kind of steals herself for her first customer. And lo and behold, instead of doing what is expected of him, he takes her out of the brothel, like kind of saves her from her circumstances. So of course she's very grateful and she admires him. He turns out to be a Viscount named Trevor, Viscount Trevor. But she knows that she can't, you know, nothing can happen between them because he's engaged. And so as historical romance novels especially do, you bounce back and forth between the two perspectives. So the Viscount, his name is Tristan, Tristan Trevor, that's a name for you, is engaged, and he has gone to this brothel as, like, his last hurrah, kind of, before he becomes a married man and has to settle down. And then he recognizes Violet. Like, he walks into the room and recognizes her and becomes determined to, you know, take her out of that place instead of what he originally went there for. And so he sets her up in his mistress's house. Like, he sets her up as his mistress just to give her a place to live until she figures out what she wants to do. But there's no touching. It's like mistress in name only. And so she is trying to get her life back together. She wants to find a respectable job, or like as a, you know, a governess or something like that, or find a nice man to marry. And of course the two of them have several interactions and shenanigans ensue.
A fake mistress only for a short period of time.
And so the book turns a lot of the like arranged marriage tropes kind of on their head. It's a Cinderella story, and it's also a second chance romance, which is a familiar romance trope in the romance genre, and rags to riches also. So do go check that out. Only a Mistress Will Do by Jenna Jackson. Thank you for sponsoring the show. All right. So hurt/comfort. This was such an interesting question. It's like so specific. I don't know. I've never read fan fiction for no other reason other than I just haven't. And so I had never heard of this trope before. And so I had to take this to the Book Riot back channels because, I don't know, shruggy face. And one of our contributors, I think it was Angel, recommended Lost Stars by Claudia Gray, which is a Star Wars novel. And I got so interested in reading the synopsis of it that I went out and got it from the library and I'm like halfway through it. So, and I'm loving it so much. So, it is, so yeah, start over. So it's a Star Wars novel that starts before the first movie in the original trilogy. And then the events of the book move through all three books in the original trilogy. And these are about side characters. It's not about like Han Solo or anything like that. So you're following these two kids who have grown up on a planet. It's called Jalukan. It's like way out on the far flung edges of the Empire. And they have grown up under the Empire, basically, and want to join the Imperial forces. Both of the characters, it's a little girl and a little boy, who come from like opposite sides of the tracks in this planet. Both of them want to be fighter pilots. Like, this is their greatest desire in life. And so they bond over that. They become best friends. And then eventually they fall in love. But while all of that is happening, their politics start to diverge. They go to the Imperial Academy, and then while they watch the way that the Empire runs their government, one of the characters joins the Rebel Alliance, and the other one becomes a really high-ranking officer in the Empire. So it's very star-crossed. There's that hurt-comfort thing has a lot of manifestations in the book. The female character is super, super strong, very headstrong, and it's, you know, action, there's action and angst and all of that. I've never read a Star Wars novel before, so I'm not going to say you have to have, like, read any of the other books, because I haven't, and I'm following along fine. I will say, if you haven't seen the original trilogy, you might be a little lost, so caveat to that. So that's Lost Stars by Claudia Gray.
You should also read Bloodline, which is it's a Leia story, like right after the third of the original trilogy, mm-hmm. which is technically number six, I guess, whatever. It's so good. Bloodline is great. It's really, really, yeah, I liked it a lot.
I put a picture of this up on my Instagram account when I got it from the library and was like, okay, here we go, Star Wars books. And all of the comments were like, Claudia Gray is bae.
She's go really read good. Yeah, she is. She's really good. It's funny. I didn't realize there was a name for this. But like when you think about all of the World War II novels about like, you know, the English soldier getting nursed by the whoever, you know, European nurse
by
lady. By the, you know, the insert European nurse here. It's like the same thing, which is so interesting. I had not thought of it as like a distinct trope, but of course fan fiction is on top of that. And then I was like, surely I have read like 1,000 books that have this in it, but then I couldn't think of them. And so I have one pick for you. I feel like I should have like 1,000 more, but the one I'm gonna tell you about is the one I just read, which was one, it came up during the contributor discussion of this, and it is Hawksong by Amelia Atwater Rhodes, which is the first in a series, so there is more. I guess it's like technically like middle grade or YA. I mean, it's, they do it, so are they're like going to do it by the end of the book. So whatever. But it reminded me a little bit of the Alana books in that, like, it, you know, they start out a little younger, then they get a little older. But anyway, okay. So it's about these two sort of different humanoid species. There's the like shapeshifter, they're shapeshifters. And so Danica is from the avians, and she can turn into a hawk. And then Zane is from the Serpentii, and he can turn into a snake. And they've been fighting each other forever. There's all of these, this long, long history of grudges. They're like our terrible battles. And they are both the like next in line to rule their people. And of course they have been raised to hate each other. They don't know anything about anything real about each other. Like, they've been raised to like consider the other species like completely evil from, you know, the get go. But then they have this encounter at a sort of some other, the tigers are trying to negotiate a truce, and they meet, and then they're like, could they get married and maybe end the war? But nobody wants that to happen, but they're thinking about it. And then Danica keeps getting stabbed, like, throughout the book. She gets stabbed a lot. And Zane ends up having to protect her in several, or like, nurse her back to health in several of these situations. So it is a little bit like she's a princess and she does get hurt and she has to be protected by the guy. But there's so many other things going on, and Danica is such a strong character that didn't feel cliche to me when I was reading it. And I don't know, I really enjoyed it. Like, it really, the book is basically 100% this hurt comfort trope. And it's the first in the series, which I am going to have to look at other ones. And it was the School Library Journal best book of the year. I guess they came out in like the early 2000s. I can't believe I had never read them before. Anyway, Hawk Song by Amelia Atwater Rhodes. I think you will dig it.
All right. Question two is from Aaron, who says, I've listened to the podcast from the beginning, and I've heard you answer a lot of questions about specific genres or issues. Since I read all genres, I want to open it up for you and ask, what are a couple of books that are absolute must-reads that you think a high percentage of readers have not read? I love this question. I love an opportunity to, like, shove books in people's faces, which I'm sure surprises you since I have a podcast.
Shocking,
for it.
Shocking.
Anyway, so my pick for this is The Cue by Basma Abdelaziz. And this came out last year from Melville House, which is a great independent press that I really like. It's only got 118 reviews on Goodreads, which is really a very small number. And most people that I talk to haven't even heard of it, let alone read it. But I loved it. So it's an Orwellian, very Orwellian, really short novel about like a modern Egypt. It takes place in an unnamed city after a fictionalized version of the Arab Spring. So all of the characters in the book are gathered around the gate, which is like a literal gate that opens up into the authoritarian regime's government building. And this is right after a failed populist uprising has been quashed by the government. And all of the citizens are now required to get permission from the gate in order to do just the most basic things in life. Get a job, move, drive a car, get basic health care, find child care, all of these sorts of, go to school, that sort of thing. So the line is getting longer and longer. The problem is, what makes this really Orwellian and also very Kafkaesque at the same time, is that the gate never opens. So it's this like comedic, bureaucratic hell set against an authoritarian regime that is constantly watching its citizens and is extremely violent. So you follow a really mixed cast of characters as they essentially move into the line outside of the gate. And the main character is, his name is Tarek. Tarek is the doctor. I can't remember the name of the main character, hashtag always. But he was shot during the uprising and is waiting for permission from the gate in order to have the bullet removed from his body. But the government has that kind of, you know, doublespeak Kellyanne Conway alternative facts thing happening and denies that the uprising ever happened in the first place. So he can't have been shot because there was no event for him to get shot during. So despite the fact that he's like standing there in line bleeding, they will not give him permission to have the bullet removed from his body. And so he is struggling with that, obviously. And then he encounters a doctor who has a lot of, you know, principles and obviously wants to help this person because it's his job, but if he does it, he'll get arrested and tortured. So there's like that moral complexity. Anyway, it's just like, it's obviously very relevant to things that are going on both overseas and in the US. It's really well written. I read it in like a sitting and kind of like broke out into a cold sweat. And it's just an odd kind of dystopia. It's a lot of people call it science fiction, but nothing sciencey or even really that fictitious happens, but it is an interesting take on the dystopian genre. So that's The Cue by Basma Abdelaziz.
Co-sign that one.
So good. So weird.
So weird. Very, very weird. Okay. Yes, thank you for the opening, the blank check. So I picked a book that I just finished reading, and the recommendation originally came from Nisi Shal, who spoke at Book Riot Live last year, and we did a series of interviews on the blog, on the Book Riot Live blog, that I asked every author to pick another author that they wish people would read, or a book they wish people would read, and she picked Mama Day. So it's been on my list since then. So Mama Day by Gloria Naylor is, wow, it's an amazing book, and I am so excited that I can tell you about it, but also so sad that so few people have read it. So this is your like invitation to join me in marveling at how good this book is. It's about two generations of women in the present day. It is a novel that contains multiple generations, but most of the story takes place in one time period. So it's not like spanning several lifetimes. It's just that it refers back to things that happened several generations ago. And the main character, Coco, is her nickname. She is the niece of this very formidable woman who lives on an island called Willow Springs, which is like off the coast of Georgia and North Carolina and doesn't technically belong to either. So, and the people who live there are descendants of a plantation owner and his slave his female slave who got him to deed the land to her sons. And so they have lived there for forever. They're kind of like autonomous. It's a very small town, very like, you know, internally clicky, and everybody knows everybody and everybody knows everybody's business. So Coco goes off to New York City to like, you know, find a job and a husband and get away from all of that. And the book follows her in her quest to like find a husband. She finds the guy and brings him home. But it's a magical realism novel. So all of this crazy stuff happens throughout the course of the book that like some of it's pretty legit. And then some of it you're like, in the best possible way. And it is so emotional. Like I finished this book and I was like, just kind of wrecked for a whole day. It was really intense. I cannot tell you why, because it's very spoilery. But if you are looking for it, a lot of people ask for books that have like the place as character, and Willow Springs has so much character. I know a lot of you do like elements of magic in your fiction, and this is really good. It's an amazing book by a Black woman about Black women, so that's incredible. I mean, there's just so many reasons that everybody should read this book, including that Nisi Shal, who is also amazing, recommended it. So that is Mama Day by Gloria Naylor. Everyone go read it. Okay. Next question is from Anonymous, and it says, so here's kind of an oddball feminist mom issue. I have been very conscious of making sure my son has books that show girls and women as heroes and main characters, and now that we're starting to read chapter books together, I've realized they pretty much all have been about girls. I'd love some recommendations of beginning chapter books with boy main characters who get up to fun adventures. Girl-centered books we've enjoyed are Princess in Black, Dory Phantasmagori, and Mercy Watson. Also, he's a little bit freaked out by monsters/dragons, so he'd prefer books without any freaky creatures. Thanks so much for your help in raising a woke feminist little man. Very cute. I've been talking for a minute, so Amanda, you go.
Okay. Come sit by me. This mom needs to come to my house. Same. Like, I have had the same sort of thing and with my boys, and have gone searching for the same kinds of books. You mentioned bonus points if they pass the Bechdel test and if the characters are multicultural. And so I think my recent favorite of my kids, who were six and have just started getting into chapter books, is The Mysterious Moonstone by Eric Looper. And this is the first book in a series called The Key Hunters series, and they're really fun, like Sherlock Holmesy style mysteries, set for, you know, little kids because they're chapter books. And these have two main characters, Cleo and Evan, a girl and a boy. Evan is African-American, so there's some multiculturalism happening. And it's just super fun. They go, like, in The Mysterious Moonstone, which is the first one, they go back in time. Is it back in time? No, they get stuck in a book. That's right. I couldn't remember which one it was. They, like, portal fantasy style, get transported into a book, which is a Sherlock Holmes era kind of thing, except without, instead of Sherlock, you've got like a 16-year-old boy detective, and instead of a Watson, you have a dog named Watson, who is his buddy. So they both go into the book and back in time into the Sherlock era period of like Victorian England. And they are in a mansion where a moonstone, a really, really large diamond, has gone missing. Every member of the family is a suspect, and they have to help Archie, the detective who is on the case, solve the crime. There's no monsters or anything like that. I think in the second book there are like really dangerous sharks, but there's no dragons or any sort of supernatural monster thing happening. And the both of the characters are really smart in different ways. One of them is really good at math. One of them is really good at like English and wordplay. So there's really something for every like kid here, along with just like adventures, and it's great. So that's The Mysterious Moonstone by Eric Looper.
This was hard for me because most of the books that I enjoy and also that my nephews enjoy are like full of aliens and dragons and monsters, and so it was really hard. But then I remembered Flat Stanley, which has been like updated a lot. So the Flat Stanley series by Jeff Brown and Scott Nash is about a boy named Stanley Lambchop who wakes up one morning to find out that a bulletin board fell on him during the night, and now he is flat. He's only half an inch thick. And so he proceeds to have all these adventures that you can only have if you are, like, two-dimensional, basically. He gets to, like, fly like a kite, and he helps catch art thieves because that's what you do when you're flat, it turns out. And it's the first in a whole series of books. And so I thought those might be fun and also like an opportunity to talk about like dimensions in space, like, cause you know, never gonna give up a learning opportunity, right? So that is the Flat Stanley series by Jeff Brown.
All right, question four. Let's see. In June, I'm heading to the national parks out of Vegas, the Grand Canyon, Monument Valley, Bryce Canyon, and Zion, plus New Orleans. Do you have any book recs for some pre-trip reading and for my long flight from Melbourne to the U.S.? Okay, I picked The Hour of the Land by Terry Tempest Williams. The subtitle is A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. And so this is part memoir, part, like, environmental history, national history, or natural history rather, and then like also some social policy critique all combined into one thing. So she's doing an overarching look at America's national parks. She spends some time talking specifically about like the Grand Tetons, which are in Wyoming, and Acadia Park in Maine, and a couple others. I don't remember which ones, but she's examining mostly the national park spaces as a whole and what we went through as a nation to like develop them and our impact, the impact of our policy of like establishing the national parks and maintaining the national parks on those areas of land. But it's also very much about like what national parks mean to the American spirit and how these wide open wild spaces are really very like American concept, and how as time has gone on, we are getting less and less publicly concerned with maintaining the national parks, but like the attendance is still 300 million people visit the national parks in the U.S. every year. So obviously as a country, we like still crave that wildness and that outdoor space and that unplugging, but our environmental policies and destructive consumerist habits tell another story basically. So it's really kind of a love letter, especially her personal love letter to America's national parks. Terry Tempest Williams writes a lot of nature books and has a deep personal connection to these spaces. So I think it would be a nice thing to read when you're about to go into these spaces. So that's The Hour of the Land by Terry Tempest Williams.
Terry forever.
So much.
I picked a book for you that is not about national parks per se, but it is about the desert, and all of the places you're going are desert parks. So it is Desert Notes by Barry Lopez. And this is a book that I first came across when I was a bookseller in Salt Lake City, Utah, and we sold just like a bajillion copies of it, which is weird because it's not a major publisher. It's a little hard to find, but it's a really great book. It's a short story collection, and Lopez's prose is very sort of surreal and dreamy. So it's like, you know, you're out in the desert, you're kind of wandering around, and like maybe you're a little dehydrated and disoriented. Like, that's what it's like to read this book. But he has a real feel for sort of that feeling of being in the desert and why it's special and important and unlike being in any other kind of geography. So I thought it would be a good compliment, and also like a good plane book, because, you know, when you're on a plane, like sometimes things are a little dreamy and weird anyway. So that's, at least that's my experience of flying. So I thought it would be a good fit. So that is Desert Notes, Reflections in the Eye of a Raven by Barry Lopez. And let's see. Oh, it's time for our second sponsor already. Look at that. Which is, oh, it's not me, but I'm going to tell you about it. It's the Baker Street 4 by, it's got several people who it is by. Where are their names? J.B. Gian and Olivier Legrand are the authors, and David Etienne is the artist, and I'm looking at it, and it is very nice, you guys. So what it is a graphic novel about the Baker Street Irregulars, which is one of my favorite things of Sherlock Holmesian lore. It's the Irregulars. I love the Irregulars. And in this case, they're four young boys in London. It's got like a little bit of a Newsies feel to it. Like, they've got their little hats. And their little, like, side bags. Oh, my gosh. Sorry. Okay, I'm getting sidetracked.
And then we lost Jen forever.
Sorry. So it's about three boys, Billy, Charlie, and Tom. And they are sort of street kids, and they are helping, Sherlock Holmes solve crimes. And then Tom's girlfriend gets kidnapped, so they have to go solve their own mystery. And then there is somebody who gets framed for being Jack the Ripper, and they have to find out the truth about that. And it's got all of these different adventures that they go on, which is very fun and exciting. So if you love Sherlock Holmes, if you like stories about street kids in history, I don't think you need to know all of the things about Sherlock Holmes to enjoy this. It's just really fun, like historical London hijinks with, you know, boys. Who doesn't like that? And the art is beautiful. I really love the style of this art. It's very nice. So that is The Baker Street 4 by J.B. Gian, Olivier Legrand, and an art by David Etienne, and thank you so much for sponsoring the show. Okay, so our next question is me. Okay, here we go. It's from Autumn, who says, I am friends with two sisters that will be recognizing the first anniversary of their brother's death this year. It's been a rough year for both of them in regards to other issues. When their brother passed, I gave them tiny, beautiful things, and they both loved and appreciated it. I know that another book has been recommended before that is similar, but I'm unable to find it. Please recommend any books that may help with grief. We all appreciated the way Tiny, Beautiful Things allowed and validated all the feelings. It's such a good way to describe that book. It really does allow and validate the feelings. So I'm just going to keep talking since here I am. And the pick, I was trying to think of what you might have heard us talk about before. And it occurred to me that The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion also has a lot of allowing and validating the feelings. So that is what I am recommending. It's a memoir. Joan Didion is an amazing classic writer. But this is about her and her husband seeing their daughter fall ill, and then after her daughter falls ill, her husband suffers a massive coronary. So this is, you know, about her having been through one situation involving, you know, medical issues with family, and then a completely unexpected one. So there's a lot of things going on in here. She's talking about, you know, what it's like to be afraid of losing a child and then what it's like to be afraid of losing a spouse. It's about, you know, memory, like thinking about them in the past versus in the present, and just about how you live through that. So I think that this might have a lot of things that they could relate to. And it's just she's an incredible writer. She is just really, really good at, you know, pulling the perfect kernel of the emotion and putting it into words. So that is The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion.
Okay, I went with Grief is a Thing with Feathers by Max Porter, which is actually a novel, novella? It's like 100 pages. It's very short. And I didn't know if fiction was necessarily what you were looking for, but it so perfectly handles grief, especially grief when you've lost somebody prematurely, like somebody who was young, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So it's about a father who's like a scholar of Ted Hughes and has two boys. They live in London, and his wife has died unexpectedly in an accident. So he is suddenly a widower. His boys suddenly have no mother, and they are dealing with their newfound grief in their own ways. So the chapters go back and forth between the perspectives of the two boys, the dad, and then also a character called the Crow, which is just the weirdest. It's so weird and beautiful and weird, and I don't know how else to describe it, but the Crow is like this embodiment of the universe's insufferable angst, I guess. Like, I don't know how else to describe it, who comes into this home and babysits this newly grieving family. And the Crow speaks from the first person and says stuff about how, like, he's not interested in humans except when they're grieving, because those are our only honest moments. And he stays with them for weeks and months as the family kind of finds their new normal, and the pain of losing a loved one becomes less physical and more about like memories, and they start to heal and come together and learn how to function as a threesome in a house without a mother or a wife to care for them. And it's really touching and heartbreaking and strange and like otherworldly, and kind of brilliant. I don't know. I was looking for less of like a how to get over the loss of a person you loved, and more of something that would like, this is a human feeling, this thing that you're going through, even though it's been a year, you know, it's still okay to feel the way that you do. And I think this little book really does express that very well. So that's Grief is the Thing with Feathers by Max Porter. Okay, it probably me. Yep. Okay, this is from Lauren, who says, over the past few years, I've come to develop an affinity for poetry, something I never thought I'd enjoy. Favorites have included Anne Carson, Mary Oliver, Orson Shire, Prelude to a Bruise by Saeed Jones, Bluets by Maggie Nelson, Milk and Honey by Rupi Kapoor, Night Sky with Exit Wounds, that's a really good one, and she names a few more, Langston Hughes and Seamus?
Seamus.
Seamus Heaney. Heaney? Whoa.
Heaney. Seamus Heaney. Also, what? It's Rupi Kaur, just quick note.
Thank you.
No problem.
We're reading Loves of Mine before I expanded my horizons with more poetry, and I still adore them both. With all of that, what's some poetry, contemporary or classic, that I'm missing out on? More poets that will further my love of poetry. Okay, I'll just keep going. My pick for you is Bestiary by Donica Kelly, which came out last year from Grey Wolf, which, just as a side note, Grey Wolf consistently puts out amazing poetry collection. So if you just like go to their website and click on a collection of poems, you're going to find something to like. But I really, really enjoy this one. It came out in November or October of last year. And it's about dealing with the inner, like, you know, your inner life and pain. And Donica Kelly writes about like sexual assaults and body image and all sorts of things that you deal with on a day-to-day basis, but told from the perspective of like, through this lens of animalia, like whales and ostriches, and there's a centaur and griffins and all of these existing and imaginary animals that she uses to dissect her life and the lives of pretty much everybody else on the planet. They're really, really beautiful and very accessible. So I think that if you don't say that you're new to poetry, but it's a thing that you've just recently come to love, I think this is a really good pick for that. So that's Bestiary by Donica Kelly.
All right. I am recommending Camille T. Dungy, who I recently discovered because I was reading a galley of her essay collection, which comes out in June, called Guidebook to Relative Strangers. And I am much more likely to pick up an essay essay collection by a poet than a poetry book by a poet, which is, I know, I'm terrible. But after reading her essays, I then went looking for her poetry, and she is amazing. So I think you could really probably pick up any of her works, but I thought you might start with Smith Blue, because that's the one I find that most of my favorite poets, poems of hers are from. And she is great because she writes a lot about nature as well as about, you know, people and feelings, which are the, you know, usual material of poetry. But you mentioned a couple of poets who, you know, I think, like Anne Carson is a favorite of mine, and that sort of dreamy surrealness, like Dungey is a little more concrete, but she has the sharpness that I find in Anne Carson. And anyway, I think you'll love her. I really don't think you can go wrong with any of her collections, but again, I think I might start with Smith Blue. And yeah, if for people looking for really amazing essay collections, Guidebook to Relative Strangers, which comes out in June, is definitely going to be worth your time. So yes, Camille T. Dungey. Read her. She's great. All right. Question 7 is from Anonymous, who says, up until recently, I was one of quote-unquote those people when it came to romance novels. And then I fell down the Courtney Milan rabbit hole and devoured both her Turner and Brothers Sinister series and have seen the error of my ways. Yes! Welcome! Welcome! Courtney Milan is so great. I love her. Okay, question continues. I really enjoyed the feminist aspect of these books and I would like to read more like them, but as I am a complete romance novice, I have no idea where to start looking. I think I would prefer recommendations of the historical type, but I'm not turning contemporary romance ones down. So I'm just going to keep talking because I'm so excited to tell you about An Extraordinary Union by Alyssa Cole, which just came out like a week ago. Did you read it yet, Amanda?
I just got it from my library. I was number one on the whole list, and I was so excited. Winner!
I know, you won. It's so good. It's so, so good. So what it is it's a historical novel set during the Civil War about a black woman who is a former slave who has an eidetic memory. She's got, like, she can remember everything, basically. And she was, when she was freed as a young girl, she was, like, trotted around as an example of, like, look, like, black people are people who can have great mental skills in support of the abolitionist cause, which has both, like, which was good and bad, because, yeah. And so, and now she's grown, and she is a spy for the Union Army, which is amazing. And while she is on this mission, she ends up falling for a man who is a detective for Pinkerton's Secret Service, so another spy. And they're both down in Virginia trying to, like, find out the heart of this plot that's happening. Malcolm, who is the other spy, is a white man. And he's been posing as a Confederate. So there's all of these layers of complications. Like, normally in romance, you know, there are obstacles. And like, whoa, hello, there are obstacles for these two. So many obstacles, both personal and, like, historical and political. But I thought she did such a good job of, like, teasing those apart and, like, finding the ways through for the characters without dismissing anything. I mean, Alyssa Cole is great, and I've been reading her for years now, and I love her work, but this book is just amazing. So that is An Extraordinary Union, which is the first in the series, God bless, by Alyssa Cole.
Okay, my pick for you is My Fair Concubine by Jeannie Lin, which takes place during the Tang Dynasty, and I love this so much. So the hero in this book, his name is Fei Long, and he is a nobleman. He's been away from his family for a long time, and then his father dies, and so he comes back to, like, run, you know, the whatever. Not castle, that's not right. Property? Sure. Estate? Whatever. When he comes home, like, everything is in a shambles. His father has left the estate in a lot of debt. Like, bill collectors are knocking on the door. And what's worse, his sister has disappeared. She's eloped with the neighbor, which is not good because she was promised to, like, a border country's leader as a way of mollifying these potential invaders. And it was, like, a very political, purposeful political union. So Faye is just like, well, what am I supposed to do with that? He like, tracks them down. He tracks his sister and her new husband down and finds them. And then feels really badly about forcing her to, like, travel thousands of miles from her home and marry someone she doesn't love. So he lets them go. And he is in this pickle now because he has to, like, provide a bride for this political marriage. And while he's in this tea house contemplating his future and mumbling about how he needs a woman, the tea servant girl overhears him, thinks she's talking to her, thinks he's talking to her, like propositioning her, and she throws the tea at him. So she gets fired and is like walking out, you know, to go beg and like figure out how to live her life. So she's walking down the road and he realizes like he can take this girl and pretend that she is his sister and train her to be a noblewoman and give her a future, since it's kind of his fault that she got fired. And so he proposes this plan to her and she agrees because she doesn't have any other option. So she goes to his home and starts to like undergo training for how to be a noblewoman. And in the meanwhile, of course, they fall in love, but they can't get married because she has to go marry this political guy. Like, how many brides are we going to go through before this poor guy can get a wife, you know? And so there's like, it's so many complications. There's class problems and barriers and political barriers and all this stuff. Both of the characters are really, really proud. So there's an added layer of like, well, I don't want you anyway on every page, which is amazing. They've got really great romantic tension. And I really love this, historical setting, because it's, one I wasn't particularly familiar with when I started reading Jenny Lind's novel. She's got a whole series of Tang Dynasty historical romances that are just so great. So that's My Fair Concubine by Jenny Lind.
I have read others in that series and loved it, but now I did not realize that the first one was like a twisted My Fair Lady. Like, what? I'm going to have to pick that up sooner rather than later. That's amazing.
All right. Question 8. My brother, who's about to finish medical school, just finished When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi, and asked me if I knew any similar books that are, in his words, quote, kind of discussing death and facing mortality and whatnot, end quote. I recommended Being Mortal by Otoga Wande, but drew a blank beyond that. He would obviously be drawn to stories by or about those in the medical profession, but I think he'd like anything that deals philosophically with life, death, and mortality. Okay, my selection is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory by Caitlin Doughty. This is a memoir, by Caitlin Doughty, obviously, about her time working in a crematorium. So when she was 20, she graduated with a degree in medieval history, which was ultimately useless. And as someone with a history degree, I feel your pain. And so she took a job at a crematory, sort of out of a combination of like morbid curiosity and also you're hiring, so I will accept this position. And so she kind of ends up sort of loving it, which is a strange word to use to describe a job spent burning dead bodies. And this is all about, it's like a behind the scenes look both at what happens to your body when you're cremated and what it's like to work in a crematory, but also how American capitalism has kind of warped both our death industry, to like, not to put too fine a point on it, and how we interact with the end of our lives in general. So it's a lot about, you know, the nuts and bolts of working there. But there's a really, it's an interesting look at the philosophy of death and how we handle death and the funeral industry and all of those sorts of things. And near the end of the book, Caitlin leaves to go start her own funeral home, and she's doing death in like an entirely different way. She has like this company, I think it's called The Good Death, where like she will take bodies and put it out in nature and just let what happens to you happen. Like, it's all very strange and interesting and really thought provoking. As many people who are young hadn't like thought about what I would do with myself once I died. So I thought a lot about it after reading this book. And I listened to it on audio. She's a great narrator of the book. The author narrates it. But some of it is like, if you have kids in the car, there are chapters about like what happens to fat when it burns in a crematory, and that are maybe not appropriate. So just to warn you, if you're an audiobook listener, be aware of your surroundings. I'm just saying. So that's Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory by Caitlin Doughty.
Interesting.
Super gross.
I was like, it's like Mary Roachy in that way. Like, yes, it's very factual and also gross. Excellent. Okay. Well, I picked less gross in theory. I don't know. I picked Knocking on Heaven's Door by Katie Butler, so Katie Butler is a journalist, and she was living really far from her parents when she found out that her father, who was 79 at the time, had a stroke that left him basically crippled, like really unable to care for himself or communicate well or anything like that. So they figured that, you know, this was it, like he was going to die. And then he got a pacemaker, but he didn't fix anything else. So he was still living, but then he was developing dementia and he was almost blind and he was miserable. And the family was really struggling with this. And then on top of it, her mother was facing an illness of her own. So Butler, you know, is not only trying to deal with how her family is approaching death, but because she's a journalist, she starts researching like medical intervention and the American way of death and why we do things the way that we do. So she's asking really hard questions based on her own experiences about like, why do we do certain medical procedures on people who are, you know, facing potentially, you know, the end of their lives? Why do we do, what is the, you know, system of near death, you know, intervention that we have put in place? How did it get there? Why do we continue doing the things that we do? And so she's asking all of these questions and trying to figure it out in both for our, like in general, and then in the specifics of her own life. So it's not a medical professional, but she's dealing a lot with the medical profession is why I'm recommending this. Because I thought it might be interesting for him to see something from sort of the patient's side view. Because, you know, when you're a doctor, like the goal is to preserve life, right? Like that's the end of the sentence. But for some other people, it may perhaps seem like that is not what is the appropriate response. So this is, it's about the medical system. It's about our personal decisions with aging family members. It's about what our aging family members should or should not be able to choose to do. Lots of big, difficult, complicated questions, but she does a good job of examining them. And so that is Knocking on Heaven's Door by Katie Butler. And that's our show. Thank you so much. There's a lot of death in this one. Yeah. It happens sometimes. That was our theme for today. You're welcome. So thank you so much for listening. If you have a chance to leave us a review on iTunes, it is always greatly appreciated. We love hearing your feedback, and it also helps other people to find the show. Thank you so much to our sponsors, and thanks to you for listening. You can find us on social media. I'm Jen IRL, Jen with two N's, IRL, and Amanda is I'm Amanda Nelson, and we will talk to you next time.